So, mindfulness practice or mindfulness meditation is closely related to the idea of living a conscious life. To be conscious of what you're doing, be conscious of your intentions. Some people talk about it as being closely related to a life of mindfulness is a life that's intended, an intentional life, that we know what we intend, what our intentions are, what our motivations are, and we consciously, knowing that, we consciously get behind or get interested. We devote ourselves mindfully to what we intend. And we sit down to do mindfulness meditation with some intention. We sit down to do the meditation with the idea of being conscious of what we're about to do. And I know that it's happened for me a lot, and I'm sure it's for many of you, that there can be a kind of casualness in sitting down to meditate. You know, it's a good idea, it seems important, but you know, it's kind of like find yourself sitting and the mind has been wandering all day, and just it's fine, you just continue wandering, and you know, the mind has hardly noticed that you've sat down. You know, some part of you knows you've done it, but the mind hasn't been told. But to sit down with some being conscious of what you're doing, and being conscious of what the intention is, what the purpose is of what you're doing here, being conscious of some of basically how you are at that time and your feelings and the momentum that's going on in your life leading up to that period of meditation. The idea is to start to become conscious of what's actually going on in our life. And the beauty about being conscious is it's not the intention of Buddhist practice for us to become judgmental of what we become aware of. It's simply to notice clearly, be mindful clearly, well, this is what's going on now, so we can start living a conscious life. So we go into the meditation with some conscious presence. This is what I'm going to do. And this is where I am. I'm here now, in this time, this place. And I know it's not easy to stay present. The mind wanders off all too easily. And that's just part of what meditation entails, is working with that and recognizing that. And when the mind does wander off, to come back and come back with some clear intention. This is what I'm going to do. But not to be rigid or not to be demanding or not to have the expectation that you can succeed. That just, you know, set up for suffering. But rather, the intention is a friendly one. It's kind of like the, I suppose, the theistic prayer, you know, that goes something like, ends by something like, God willing. It's kind of like that spirit in which we do mindfulness. We don't have God in mindfulness so much exactly, but, you know, Dharma willing or meditation willing. So we have to do, we make our conscious intention to be present. And we're not going to be rigid about that or have expectation how well we do. We're just going to do our best to try to be in the present moment, to stay with the breath, for example. So going into a period of meditation, there can be a conscious, like, you know, being conscious of what you're doing. And during the meditation session, there can be kind of, you can be conscious of what you're doing. You can remind yourself, oh, I'm here meditating. This is how it is for me. This is my experience as I'm sitting here, and it's not going so well today, or today I'm much more calm and settled, and kind of recognizing what's going on, being conscious of the whole process. And then at the end of a sitting, it's a wonderful time to review what has happened in the last, if you sat for half an hour, to review the half an hour, to spend 30 seconds or a minute or something reviewing as an aid, as a support of becoming more conscious of what your meditation life is like, what happens to you in meditation. And reviewing, you know, the word sati, which is the word Buddhist word for mindfulness, is very closely connected to this to the Buddhist word for remembering, remembering or memorizing. And that functions, the mental function of being mindful and the mental function of remembering something, there's a huge overlap in the mental functioning there. And the degree to which we remember, strengthen our ability to remember, it actually helps support mindfulness practice itself. So at the end of this session of meditation, to spend a little bit of time reviewing What was that like? Again, always careful. There's no need to judge how it is. No need to be critical about what it is. But just really matter of fact, kind of recognize, oh, that's what it was like today. That's, wow, this is fascinating. This is a human being's experience meditating on September 8th, year 2000. Wow. I mean, that's, you know, like you're a naturalist from Mars studying human beings, and this is what happens to a human being when they sit down to meditate. And there's no judgment. The Martian doesn't judge. It's like, you know, they're just, you know, just, it's all pretty amazing. But to review then helps to kind of maybe inculcate a tendency to be more conscious of what we're doing, to be more aware of the process, be more aware of what our tendencies are, how we work with things, how we don't work with things, what we tend to kind of ricochet off, when we tend to kind of get interested in something and stay interested, and or sometimes there's a little subtle justification, you know, and you have this wonderful fantasy about Tahiti and all the wonderful things you can do in Tahiti, and you might notice, well, I'm not very present, I'm thinking about Tahiti, but I deserve a break. I've been stressed out all day and finally have this pleasant fantasy. It's so much better than just sitting there being mindful of my breath. So I'm going to take that break and think about Tahiti. I've known people who've done comparable things to that. You kind of make these little kind of arguments inside of you or negotiations, you know, about... So to be conscious of that, to really own up to what you're actually doing, what's happening to you in your meditation. And by doing that, reviewing your meditation at the end of each sitting, just briefly, the next time you come or you develop, then you're developing a tendency, so in the future when you come to meditate, you're much more familiar of what's likely to happen. What your intention is, what your strategies are, your negotiations are, how to work with different things. Say you're sitting here and you started feeling, you had some memory of the day and it triggered some anger. So his anger bubbled up in the middle of the sitting. So you sit there, well, you can review at the end, well, how did I work with that? How did I bring mindfulness to that anger? And maybe your conclusion is, well, I didn't. Maybe I don't know how. Or maybe I'm not so interested. I was more interested in justifying why they were wrong. Or actually, I did try. I tried a little bit to note it and to feel it as a physical experience in my body. I tried to make room for it in my mind. I tried not to be riding the anger really closely and getting into the story, but I tried to just make lots and lots of room in my mind to let the anger just kind of float there in my mind, you know, on its own, show itself. And then you notice, well, what happened when I did that? What happened to the anger when I just let it kind of float in the field of awareness? And to review these things and to know these things about your practice sets yourself up so it's easier in the future. It's kind of like, becomes more kind of second nature to remain conscious and present in the process of meditation. The idea is to try to cultivate a life which is more conscious. And as we do this in meditation, it kind of by osmosis almost, it carries over into the rest of our life, where we begin living a life which is more conscious, more awake, more present, more aware of what's actually going on for us in our lives. Now, one of the functions of this kind of conscious living, being mindful and present, is to live a life which is, according in the language of the Buddha, unshakable, or develop a mind which is unshakable. And there was a famous quotation from the Buddha where he said, just like a large mountain boulder is unmoved by the wind, so a wise person is unmoved by praise and blame. So you can imagine this huge, huge boulder sitting there on top of a mountain, and the wind howls through, but the boulder doesn't move at all. It just sits there solid and massive. So a wise person also has a stability where the winds of praise and blame are not going to affect her or him. And can you say that for yourself? If someone comes along and praises you, does your mind then get active? Wow, you know, yeah, that's great. Or if someone blames you for something, criticizes you, does your mind get active? And there are these many winds that pass through our life that tends to shake us up, shake the mind up, agitate the mind. And part of living a conscious life is to start recognizing some of these winds that pass through and recognizing the way the mind gets agitated, so the mind can stop being so easily agitated by the various winds of our lives. And the Buddha Buddhism talks about 8 worldly winds that tends to shake the mind. And these are paired with each other. They're kind of opposites. And opposites are interesting because it tends to be a pendulum. We tend to go from one extreme to the other, react to. So the first pair is a gain and loss. The second pair is praise and blame. The third pair is fame and ill repute. What's the opposite of fame? Infamy. Fame and infamy. And then the last one, sometimes is translated just simply as happiness and suffering. And these are kind of worldly winds that happen to us. All these things happen to us to some degree all the time. Praise and blame, fame and infamy. I mean, that's sometimes not even our choice. You know, it just kind of happens around us. People notice that the clothes you're wearing, and suddenly you become known as a person who wears... I was reminded yesterday, I went up to the San Francisco Zen Center and had lunch there with my friends. And I sat down at a table, and they said, "Oh, we were just talking about you." Oh, great. And but there was a kind of nice, there was kind of these little silly stories of how I was when I first came to practice. And I remembered a story, probably none of them remembered. I remembered, I don't know why I'm telling you this, but I showed up to be a student at Zen Center when I was about 20 or 21. And I showed up with... Oh, I told this story because I actually met one of the people at lunch. He was the one who taught me how to shave. I didn't learn how to shave until I was 26, because you know it was back then. It was back in the, you know, men didn't shave in the 60s and 70s. Why shave? So I had this long hair and long kind of goatee. It went down. I could braid the goatee if I wanted to. So I showed up to Zen Center that way. And then I had these pink pants where the zipper didn't work. So, you know, you're just living your life, right? And you get this fame or infamy, just kind of just the clothes you wear and stuff. And so, you know, I was unshakable back then. I wasn't, you know, impressed by the fame or infamy that came with that. I think mostly because I was completely unconscious. So that's one way to be unshakable, but in Buddhism it's not the preferred way. The idea is to be completely aware and mindful, and in that very clear mindfulness, not to notice the tendencies we have to get caught by what people say around us, and praise us, and blame us, the fame we might get, the infamy we might get. How susceptible are we? How susceptible are we to contracting or getting afraid or getting elated or happy by simple statements of praise or blame? The Buddha claimed that he was unswayed by praise or blame. Someone came and said that he was the greatest. He said, "That's fine with me. I just keep teaching the Dharma." Someone comes and tells him he's the worst. Fine with him. He would just continue teaching the Dharma. He was not so concerned about the praise, or not at all concerned with praise or blame. And I know some people for whom the alternative to praise or blame, when they don't get to either one of them, is they fall asleep or they get bored. Because praise and blame excites the ego, our self-identity. It speaks to who we want to be or don't want to be. And so if someone comes along and blames you or criticizes you, many people get really awake. Wow, you know, suddenly the adrenaline goes. And if someone comes along and praises you, a lot of people will get kind of elated and up, kind of feeling uplift also. But if neither happens, some people will find kind of this dull place. It's kind of, they kind of, some people depend on feeling of threat or feeling of support in order to feel kind of energized, the caffeine of the soul. And if they don't get that, they feel disoriented. It's easier for some people to get criticism than to get nothing at all. And so part of, for some people, part of practice is to learn how to be comfortable in the middle, in the balance, where we don't need to get, we need to, our well-being is not dependent, our energy level is not dependent on praise or blame or fame or infamy. Gain and loss. Gain and loss is maybe trickier, because gain and loss is maybe not necessarily has something to do with what other people think about us, whereas praise and blame and fame and infamy is usually about what other people think. And it's common wisdom not to be concerned with what other people think about you, right? I mean, that's what my mother told me over and over again growing up. Gil, don't be concerned what other people think about you. It did a lot of good. I mean, mother's advice goes right by. But it's common wisdom. And but gain and loss, I think, sometimes is a lot trickier. Not to be caught up in gain and loss, or not to be swayed by the winds and get agitated by it. Often because it can seem to have a lot more consequence in our lives. But how can we is it possible, is it reasonable to have some equanimity of mind, some balance of mind, unshakable peace of mind, even when there's great loss? And I think there is. And is it possible to have it when there's great gain? What's most common, of course, is that we have gain and loss, and then we relate it very quickly to something very personal. We personalize it. This says something about me. I am worthy. I am unworthy. I am lovable. I'm not lovable. I'm a failure. I'm a great person. And this tendency to personalize it and make it a statement about ourselves rather than just an event that's happened is one of the reasons why gain and loss is so quickly will agitate the mind, will shake us up. But to be engaged in activity fully, completely, wholeheartedly, with no particular concern with the outcome, is one of the kind of great spiritual advice that comes down in many spiritual traditions, not just Buddhist traditions. To be responsible, careful, dedicated to what you have to do, but not to be so concerned about the outcome. Be content that you did your best. It was great when I worked in the monastery kitchen, because kitchens are really forgiving places to work, because you can fail a lot in the kitchen, and the next meal you get to do it again, start over again. And so I loved work. I worked for a year in the kitchen, and there were days when it was kind of, you know, great, and great days it was a disaster. The kitchen is a great place to kind of overcome your concern with praise and blame, because you know the whole monastery would know, you know. And, you burnt the beans, whatever. And one of the things I learned in the kitchen was not so much with the eaters, what had to say, but rather I was the kitchen foreman for a while, or a manager. And so I was in charge of assigning the jobs and monitoring the quality of the jobs. And the monastery life is very intense. It's like a pressure cooker. And I remember once telling someone, And things have to be very exact in a Zen monastery, because it's like tea ceremony, right? And in tea ceremony, if you know Japanese tea ceremony, things have to be just right. Otherwise, you know, it just doesn't work. So I remember telling someone that they needed to chop the cucumbers a little bit smaller. And she burst into tears. You know, things have such great consequence in the pressure cooker of a monastery. And one of the things I learned, and a kind of painful lesson, was the degree to which I wanted people to like me. And it's a reasonable thing to want people to like you, but I was neurotic about it. I was completely preoccupied. I mean, everybody had to like me, you know, and I would bend myself and contort myself and trying to twist and make sure that everyone kind of was always liked me. Because then I was safe, or then I whatever, I don't know what I was thinking. And it became such a hindrance to be the kitchen manager and be concerned about everybody liking me or not liking me. And eventually, I saw very clearly this tendency, and I learned I had to let go of it. That I wasn't going to be mean or anything, but I just had to get the job done. And I tried to do the best I could and the kindest I could, but I wasn't going to be doing this tremendous amount of interpersonal gymnastics and preoccupation to always get everyone else liking me. If someone didn't like me, well, that's the way it was. So where am I? Gain and loss. I just blew it, right? I don't know where I am in my talk. Gain and loss. Gain and loss in the kitchen, because you cook something and it didn't work out. And so I loved the kitchen, because next morning I always got to start over again. And I had this wonderful feeling. I'd get up in the morning and we would go sit and meditate first, and then after the period of meditation, I go put on my cook's clothes, and I just kind of feel, oh great, I get to do it again. I get to try again. I blew it yesterday, but I get to do it. I get to try again. I see if I can do it better this time. So I wasn't caught by the failures, but rather was so delighted by that I had this opportunity to try to live a conscious life, mindful life in the kitchen, and I would try to do my best. So each day, so kitchen was great. It's a place to failure, you know, gain and loss, failure and success. So how do you relate to gain and loss? How do you relate to failure and success? You take it as a personal shortcoming when there's failing, or is it just things didn't work out and you'll try again better? People who need to control their environment in order to feel secure can be very, very threatened by loss or by failure. Occasionally, they can be threatened by gain or success. Some people are very threatened by success because it implies that things might change. And then perhaps the trickiest one is happiness and suffering. And you know, you can ask, well, what's wrong with feeling happy? And what's wrong, you know, with avoiding suffering? Buddhist practice is, in a sense, dedicated to becoming happier, be freeing ourselves from the suffering. But suffering and happiness pass through our lives quite a bit. And it's very easy for our mind to get agitated by this. We get agitated because we pursue happiness, we hold on to it, we cling to it, protect it. We come to conclusions because of its presence. And the same thing for suffering. How do we relate it to our sense of self? I know there are people who relate their happiness and suffering to, they make it very personal. It's a statement about who they are. If someone asks you, how are you? How honest often are you about that's your reply? Or how often do you feel like you need to kind of put a little pleasant twist on it to make, you know, I'm happy, things are great. You know, and I don't think people are always so honest, because we don't want necessarily other people to know that we've been struggling for the last hour or days or whatever. We personalize it. So I know some people, when they suffer, will take it very personally. This says something about me personally. I'm responsible for this. I'm the one who's really messed up for me. Or there's other ways of personalizing, getting agitated on suffering. Another way is to blame other people. It's a very common strategy to feel discomfort and then look somewhere in the world, scan the world for responsibility, the blame. And not to really own up to it and live and be mindful and conscious of the suffering in oneself. But then to spill it out outside of oneself and to find blame, find other places, other people to be critical of, to find something wrong with them. People who suffer a lot, some people who suffer a lot will get so agitated by this and so afraid of it and so afraid of it being known that they'll spend time judging other people. Because as long as they're judging other people, then they're kind of put up a wall where they don't have to face themselves. You know, something's wrong out there always. So I don't know if I said it very well, but happiness and suffering can also be a source of agitation in the mind. It doesn't have to be. The mind can be peaceful. The mind can be at ease or in balance with the experience of suffering and with the experience of happiness. And that's, you know, what we're aiming for is that balance or that equanimity or that peacefulness, that unshakability of heart or of mind, where it allows these things to arise and sees them clearly, sees praise as praise, sees fame as fame, and doesn't make it anymore. Oh, I've got some fame. You know the famous story of, I think it's Hakuin, a Zen master in Japan. He was a village priest. And one of the village girls got pregnant. And when the baby was born, she refused to say who the father was. And finally, the baby was born. The parents insisted they had to know who the father was, or they would, I don't know what the threat was. And so finally, she was going to protect the real father. She said, oh, it's that, the village priest. So the parents were furious at the village priest, and so they brought the baby and said, you know, this is yours, you know. You're responsible for this, so you take care of this baby. And his reply was, oh, is that so? And he took the baby and took as good care of the baby as he possibly could. And some days or some weeks later, this young woman had a change of heart. She can well imagine maybe she felt heartbroken, being separated from her new baby. And so she finally confessed, you know, who the real father was. One of the local village boys, I suppose. And so then the parents were all distraught that they'd blamed the local village priest for something he hadn't done. And so they came to him and they apologized profusely and they want to take the baby back and let the baby give it back to the mother. And we apologize and what a terrible mistake we've made. And you know what he said? He said, oh, is that so? So a certain kind of equanimity, a certain kind of not being caught up in the drama of praise and blame and fame and infamy. So to live a conscious life, it doesn't mean a life where we force ourselves to be unshakable. It doesn't mean we try to force ourselves to live in a balanced way or force ourselves not to be swayed by the winds, the worldly winds that come through. A conscious life is one that tries to see how this works in our life and to notice clearly how we get caught by praise and blame, gain and loss, success and failure, and these kinds of polarities. And as we see very clearly and become very conscious of our tendencies and the way we react, then almost naturally we'll begin lightening up around it, softening around it. If we try to hold to the ideal of being at peace and unshakable by these things, I think the mind will just get brittle, kind of like forced and controlled. But if we actually begin to use our mindfulness to start being conscious of how actually our mind functions and how it works and our reactions and responses, then that familiarity with ourselves will lend ourselves to become more at ease, more at peace. Maybe not immediately, but with time as we become more and more familiar. I think of this as the very humane and compassionate way of mindfulness practice. It's really working with who we are, accepting who we are, and bringing clear mindfulness to who we are. not trying to force ourselves to be who we're not, but to becoming more and more conscious. It's like bringing this light of consciousness and letting it become stronger and stronger in the midst of who we are, as opposed to manipulating ourselves to be something different than who we are, just turning on the light inside so we can really see what's been in the dark for a long time. So that's my thoughts for today. How did I do? Oh well. So any questions or comments, please?
You just said right at the end about about not manipulating, like say praise came my way and I recognize it and I sort of see it and how I'm reacting to it, and then I might feel averse to it because it's like, oh, that's not good.
I don't deserve that.
Or it's not good for me. It's going to spin me off somewhere else. But I'm already spun at that point. Whatever I do, it's already started.
Yes.
And manipulation is already happening. And so even to just acknowledge the manipulating is part of it too.
Yes, exactly. So if we find ourselves caught up in manipulation, then remember the principle is we're always trying to just turn on the light brighter. So where do we need to bring our light of awareness to? Oh, the fact that I'm manipulating. That's a hugely important step.
I've been noticing lately that I can't do much really in the face of just those real conditioned reactions. But I have noticed which I might sort of classify as something coming outside myself to myself. But I have noticed what goes on to, once it's in here, what goes on between me and that right there. And it seems that's just the best I can do.
That sounds great to me. That sounds very good.
Can be unsure about that though.
Yes, Barbara.
Well, when you were mentioning sometimes having people that were very negative or people that were very positive around you, and I interpret that as being it's kind of like a hit. You get a hit from the negative or a hit from the positive. And that the state in the middle is what we're often uncomfortable with. I don't know if I got that right.
But let me kind of clarify the terms here, because positive and negative are a little bit kind of vague. What I meant was praise and blame or criticism and that kind of positive and negative. I mean, positive people are kind of just up people, enthusiastic people. And, you know, it's kind of sometimes pleasant to be around someone who's really up and happy and enthusiastic. And there's nothing wrong to get a contact hit from someone else's happiness.
I don't think Buddhism means anything wrong.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I'm not talking about being wrong or right. I'm talking about there's been a person in my life for years and years and years and years that most often will criticize me a lot. And then when this person's not criticizing me, then they're very, very nice to me. And so I'm glad that you clarified that, because the person is not, seems positive, but isn't really positive. You know, they're just like in another phase. And I was just wondering why I keep being friendly with this person. who is really mean to me quite a bit. And it seems like when things are hard for her, that she takes it out of me. That I appear, and somehow I'm the one who will kind of hear this negative stuff. And I just wondered if maybe sometimes I do that because it's, at least the person's interesting. You know, it's like when you said no attention or no nothing at all. Do you know what I mean? Like, I can't figure out any reason why I'm still friendly with this person. Because I like more positive people in my life. I'm getting more positive. I'm more positive about myself. But yet I let this person just let me have it.
Maybe the person is your Zen master.
And I'm very conscious. Like, sometimes she'll say, you're not very patient, are you? And that was what she said the other day. And that doesn't have anything to do with what had happened. But then, about a couple hours later, she's standing in my car waiting for this. And this is the person who said I wasn't very patient, you know? And so it's kind of like, but I don't say anything. And that's what bothers me. I don't know if I'm like a village priest. But I mean, it doesn't feel, I'm not coming from the same place that he's coming from. It doesn't feel good.
Yeah, I understand.
To just sort of stand there and look at what she's doing and keep taking it. And yesterday she did something over and over and over. And then the next thing she was like really nice. Just when I was going to finally maybe say something. So I just wonder if being conscious of why I'm friendly with this person would help me do something. Or do I not do anything?
Sounds like a very rich area, important area for you to explore, as long as you're in relationship with this person. Sounds like there's a lot for you to learn there. You can certainly learn maybe how not to be caught by people's criticism. It might take the power out of her criticism if she says, you know, you're not very patient, and you kind of just let it be like, you know, like nothing's been said. Just, oh, maybe so. You know, and because sometimes people need to get a reaction, and they're trying to get a reaction. If you're not reacting to it, it takes the power out of it for them, and they'll lose interest, or they'll escalate. Or
I went to a museum with her, and I sat down after the exhibit, and I said, you know, I have a bad back. I said, I don't want to do more. But she said, whenever you go to a museum, you're supposed to see the whole museum. You know, things like that. There are always pronouncements, and, you know, like.
So it might be a wonderful place as a relationship for you to learn how to not to get swayed by other people's statements. It might also be the place for you to explore how to stand up for yourself. And maybe it takes a lot of skill to learn how to speak to someone, how to stand up for oneself and take a position and say, you know, this is not acceptable. And how to do it in a way, hopefully, that's kind and the person can hear, that's useful. So it might take some consideration how to do that, but maybe that relationship is a place. You talked about you becoming more positive yourself and more up yourself in your life. That's a very important element of life, is to do that. But also, you might also, in order to support that, you might also need to learn how to take positions. And maybe she is a good place for you to learn how to take a stand. So, you know, this is not acceptable. And I don't know how you're going to say that, you know, give it a lot of thought. So it sounds like, I don't know why you're involved with this person, but it sounds like there's a lot there for you. And the other thing is, sometimes if people are very critical of us, I spend a lot of time being critical. Sometimes, if you can do it without being judgmental, it can be useful to kind of listen behind the words and see if you can feel their suffering. And that can actually change your relationship to it all if you understand that. Actually, the more time people spend being critical, the deeper and their suffering is. And if you can kind of tune into that part, it can change the relationship quite a bit. And sometimes what people most want is really to be met in their suffering. They don't know that necessarily. They want to be met in their suffering. They don't want to be met, you know, with the criticisms. You know, they don't necessarily want to. And that's kind of sometimes an uncomfortable place to live. But if you can kind of listen behind that, it's like the story, and this is maybe not a good example, but I told someone today the story of my friend who was in a little parking squabble with someone. I guess he pulled into a parking slot before someone else. And he didn't see the other person, I guess. And the other person was there first. Or something, I don't know exactly what it was. So the person was furious. And my friend kind of understood what was going on and kind of, I guess, pulled out of the way and made room for the person and something. And the person was really furious and yelling, and my friend kind of apologized. And then he said, kind of, probably in the right tone of voice, and you have to be careful how you do these things, right? He said, you're having a hard day today, aren't you? And immediately the person just relaxed and said, yeah, it's been really difficult today. And so he was able to listen behind the criticism at the suffering, and he could identify it and call it, you know, name it, and see the person there, and the person actually was able to relax, being seen much more deeply what was going on. Please.
At the end of the sitting, you said, what could you have done differently? And for those of us who are starting and learning to be mindful in our breathing, would you answer that question for me? What could we have done differently to try to be more mindful and to try to bring our wandering mind back?
I find myself a little bit reluctant to kind of give general statements like that, but rather more curious to know what your experience was and then to give you specific based on your experience. But if you will, if you insist, I'll make some general kind of across-the-board statements. Do you either want to be more specific or you'll make some general statements?
I found myself, my mind wandering a lot to various roles in my life, and my daughter and her pain when she was scratched by a cat just before I left to come here. And I did think about my upcoming vacation. I was just repeating where my mind wanders to, at least tonight, when we were in the sitting, and I was thinking back on how I was wandering back to my daughter's pain or my upcoming vacation. And so those are a couple of specific examples where I was aware that my mind was going someplace else instead of staying here.
So in relationship to simply being with the breath, which is only one corner of mindfulness practice, you might review, you know, kind of notice, well, how serious was I about being with my breath? Did I actually come here, you know, really intent, and did I really make it my conscious intention? And did I really kind of feel that this was really important to do, or did I understand there was real value, deep value, in following the breath as opposed to being concerned about my daughter or my vacation? Because that's actually very tricky for some people. People have some general idea that being with the breath and meditation is a good idea, but it doesn't really carry the same value as, you know, working on a relationship or thinking about some major conflict in our life. So maybe it's to clarify, you know, to really understand, maybe I need to understand better how mindfulness of breathing is really a profound thing and very valuable. So it's easier to let go of very important concerns like your daughter. And so it takes some review, some reflection of, you know, do I understand the value of this enough so that I'm willing to let go of these other concerns? And then if you understand that, then it can be easier to let go of them. With vacation, for example, I mean, how important is that to think about? You know, is that really what you want to spend your precious time meditating, doing? So those kinds of reflections can be helpful. Something else you might do is notice the quality of your breathing. Not just simply be aware that you're breathing, but the quality of it. And notice, for example, that when you start getting involved in concerns, the breath gets tight or constricted. And then maybe what I could have done is I could have breathed a little bit more consciously for two or three breaths and broke through the constriction, kind of softened it a little bit. And then it would have been easy. It's actually easier to be present for the breath if the breath is relaxed. If we get anxious and the breath gets anxious, it's almost as if it kind of supports or a preoccupation. It's easier to stay unconscious. In the kind of full instructions of mindfulness, what we might do in that kind of situation is not go back directly to the breath, but turn our attention to the emotions underlying those kinds of concerns. So not the concerns about your daughter or your concerns about vacation, but to really connect in the present moment, in this place right here, right now, in me, what are the emotions that seem to be fueling this kind of concern? The anxiety or the worry or the delight or whatever it might be. And then bring our full mindfulness on the actual emotion. And that can help settle our concern, so we're not getting so caught up in the ideas. And then once we're more settled with the emotion, then it can be easier to come back to the breath. And if we keep coming back to the breath without really acknowledging the larger emotions that are really going on, it can be really hard to stay with the breath. Is this at all helpful? Yes?
I'm kind of confused. If you have somebody in your life who takes great pleasure in inciting blame and guilt that you have to be around, is it better to just say, oh, really? Or is it better to take a stand?
I don't know. I can't. I mean, for some people, it might be better to say, "Oh, and, you know, oh, is that so?" and kind of smile and wink at them or something. and for other people, that's the wrong call and the right thing. And sometimes that's the wrong call, and sometimes that's the right call. I can't tell you that unless I know the details of the situation. That's your call. That's your investigation. Yes, please.
Okay, just in response to that, I certainly don't have the answer, but for myself, sometimes I find it helpful to see the difference between observation and reaction. Sometimes I find it helpful if I just observe what's going on and as opposed to reacting to it. Many times I feel that if I'm reacting at something, so it's like my stuff gets involved and I become judgmental. But if I can just observe it without judgment, then it's clear for me what the reality is at that moment. In terms of, for example, I tend to, I have this staff, I work in social work, and people sometimes see me having this very novel kind of personality. So I often get clients who are very, very difficult, because people think it doesn't bother me. But it doesn't matter what people say to me, that I'm always calm. But that's not real. That's not really how I feel inside. But I feel that the people who often are the most angry and who are most blaming have the most to teach me. Because what I find when I observe and don't react to what's being said is I see not what's being said, but I see that all of this anger and all of this blaming is not me at all. And it's not even necessarily the person who's saying it. But I see the suffering that the person is experiencing while they're saying it. And the anger to me is not something I need to personalize. And I could give lots of examples, but I don't think it would be that helpful, except to say that the more that I observe and the less that I react, the more more real it is for me, and the easier it is for me to listen.
Beautiful. Thank you. Very nice. So let's end with a short sitting.